Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again for our weekly reflection on the Sunday Gospel. By the intriguing title of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, it's the weekly brainchild of my colleague Jill Bevilacqua and begins precisely with the reading of this week's Gospel.
Jesus said to his disciples, "If your brother should commit some wrong against you, go and point out his fault, but keep it between the two of you. If he listens to you, you have won your brother over. If he does not listen, however, summon another so that every case may stand on the word of two or three witnesses. If he ignores them, refer it to the church. If he ignores even the church, then treat him as you would a Gentile or a tax collector. I assure you, whatever you declare bound on earth shall be held bound in heaven, and whatever you declare loosed on earth shall be held loosed in heaven. Again I tell you, if two of you join your voices on earth to pray for anything, whatever, it shall be granted you by my Father in heaven. Where two or three are gathered in my name, there am I in their midst."
This gospel is chiefly concerned with what's described as brotherly correction, and Matthew is at great pains to explain how we should go about this. As a present-day scholar writes,
"When one of these disciples loses his way by taking the wrong road, the community must be like the divine shepherd who goes in search of the lost sheep. Matthew offers an actual rule for the recovery of these brothers in crisis. It was perhaps standard practice in his church and comprised three acts or stages in brotherly correction. First of all, there's personal contact. Then comes the support of other brothers. And finally, there's the whole ecclesia, or Christian assembly, or congregation, who seek to bring the brother or sister to the fullness of communion. This communion is broken if the sinner remains stubborn, and in this case, the church has the power of binding and loosing, that is, of judging or condemning, and pardoning. Of course, the hoped-for goal is that of pardon, which must always be sought for as the final solution."
It's always interesting to compare our modern translations of the scriptures with those in use previously. Even the titles given to the different chapters are revealing of the mentality of the time. Instead of brotherly correction, my old New Testament has "to denounce to the church incorrigible sinners, and to look upon such as refuse to hear the church as heathens." One can almost hear the righteous crying out, "Let him be anathema." The opening words of this gospel, however, are different even in the modern versions. Instead of "if your brother should commit some wrong against you," the Jerusalem Bible has simply "if your brother does something wrong." And instead of "point out his fault," we have the colloquial "have it out with him." But of three modern versions, none has the strong verb used in the old translation, "rebuke him." How much more careful we've become of other people's feelings, at least in our precepts. In the book of Leviticus, we read,
"You must not bear hatred for your brother in your heart. You must openly tell him, your neighbour, of his offence. This way you will not take a sin upon yourself."
Whereas in Ecclesiasticus, we have this surprising statement.
"Question your friend. He may have done nothing at all, and if he has done anything, he will not do it again."
St. Paul, in his letter to the Thessalonians, advised his followers,
"If anyone refuses to obey what I have written in this letter, take note of him and have nothing to do with him, so that he will feel that he is in the wrong, though you are not to regard him as an enemy, but as a brother in need of correction."
And there's a significant warning in his letter to the Galatians when he says,
"If any one of you misbehaves, the more spiritual of you who set him right should do so in a spirit of gentleness, not forgetting that you may be tempted yourselves.
While James concludes his letter with these words.
My brothers, if one of you strays away from the truth and another brings him back to it, he may be sure that anyone who can bring back a sinner from the wrong way that he has taken will be saving a soul from death and covering up a great number of sins.
Another important point in this treatment of the erring individual is the reference to two or three witnesses. This is a practice the Jews had, and, comments our modern scholar, suggests that the early Christian communities were not very different from the Jewish ones. Our Lord himself, we read in John, referred to this when the Pharisees told him that his testimony was not valid because he was testifying on his own behalf. In your law, he said, it is written that the testimony of two witnesses is valid. Back in Deuteronomy, we read,
a single witness cannot suffice to convict a man of a crime or offence of any kind. Whatever the misdemeanour, the evidence of two witnesses or three is required to sustain the charge.
And St. Paul quotes these very words in his second letter to the Corinthians. While in the letter to the Hebrews, there's a pretty horrific reminder of the ancient ways.
Anyone who disregards the law of Moses is ruthlessly put to death on the word of two witnesses or three.
One's mind goes immediately to the woman caught in adultery. And at this point, it seems apt to quote a famous example of brotherly correction. Doubly significant because it took place between two brothers. In this letter, Bernard of Clairvaux is writing to the abbot of Trois-Fontaines.
I will tell you about something that once happened to me. It was when my brother Bartholomew was still alive. One day, he displeased me. Trembling with rage and using a threatening expression and tone of voice, I ordered him to leave the monastery. He immediately walked out, went to one of our barns, and stayed there. When I learned of this, I wanted to call him back, but he stated his conditions. He would only return if he were received in his own rank, not in the last rank and as a fugitive, but as if he'd been sent away lightly and without just cause. He maintained that he should not have to submit to due process of the rule for his return, since proper procedures had not been observed in his dismissal. Distrusting my own judgment of this response and of my own actions, and because of the ties of blood between him and me, I entrusted the decision of this affair to the hands of all the brethren. Thus, they judged, in my absence, that his return should not be subject to the letter of the rule, since it was certain that his dismissal had not been conducted in a regular fashion.
This text was taken from one of the exhortations to forgiveness contained in Bernard's correspondence. Now, for the layperson, and even more so for those outside the church, the idea of grown men and women accusing each other of wrongdoing and being subjected to public penance seems to belong to the Middle Ages. But in religious life, to a certain extent, it is still common. But indeed, it goes back even further than the Middle Ages. In his rule, St. Benedict instructed the abbot,
let him be prudent in his correction, lest while he strive to scour off the rust, he break the vessel.
And St. Francis of Assisi, in his admonitions, has these words under the title True Correction.
Blessed that religious who takes blame, accusation, or punishment from another as patiently as if it were coming from himself.
In her biography of Merton, Monica Furlong writes in detail on the subject of faults and their correction.
A regular feature of life at Gethsemane, as at most monastic houses of this period, was the chapter of faults. Its frequency depended on the wishes of the abbot, but it was within the regulations to hold it every day except Sundays and holy days. At the invitation of the abbot, monks came forward, bowed low, and accused themselves of faults in carrying out the rule. Others also were invited to proclaim the faults of the individual with the words, I proclaim Father X, and going on to state the faults he had noticed. It is to be regarded as a fault to excuse oneself, even though we are not guilty. The superior imposed penances for faults, varying from light to grave. For a light fault, the monk might take his meals after the rest of the community and be deprived of any duty in choir. At each office, he would prostrate himself on the presbytery step. or he might have to accuse himself in the refectory, or read some relevant portion of a pious book aloud, or say a prayer, perhaps with his arms extended in the form of a cross. Or he might eat at a small stool in the middle of the refectory instead of at table, or be instructed to prostrate himself at the door of the refectory, so that everyone who entered had to step over him, or have to kiss the feet of the whole community, bowing to them two at a time between the exertion. All these practices had in common, and had been in common in medieval times, and had been hallowed by unbroken tradition since. The total stylization of punishment to faults, in a sense, robbed it of some of the pain. Everyone partook of the experience, and always in the same way. Yet it was without doubt humiliating, and intended to be so. Writing of Mother Birchman's, Merton describes with feeling the postulant who would fall on her knees and accuse herself of dissipation, or read in a loud, clear voice St. Benedict's ninth and tenth degrees of humility concerning monks who talk too much or laugh too much. The rule is careful to demand of novices, he says, that they be zealous for humiliations.
And now, before turning to the last part of our gospel, here's a light-hearted poem I came across in an anthology of 20th-century verse. It's by John Mead Faulkner, and is called After Trinity. It could be relevant for any Sunday at this time of the year. It matters little that the writer has counted only 25 Sundays.
We have done with dogma and divinity, Easter and Whitsun past. The long, long Sundays after Trinity are with us at last. The passionless Sundays after Trinity, neither feast day nor fast. Christmas comes with plenty, Lent spreads out its pall, but these are 25, the longest Sundays of all. The placid Sundays after Trinity, wheat harvest, fruit harvest, fall. Spring, with its burst, is over, summer has had its day. The scented grasses and clover are cut and dried into hay. The singing birds are silent and the swallows flown away. Post puniam pausa fiet, Lord, we have made our choice. In the stillness of autumn quiet, we have heard the still small voice. We have sung, O where shall wisdom, thick paper, folio, voice? Let it not all be sadness, not omnia vanitas. Stir up a little gladness to lighten the tibi crass. Send us that little summer that comes with Martinmas. When still the cloudlit dapples the windless cobalt blue, and the scent of gathered apples fills all the storerooms through, the gossamer silvers the bramble, the lawns are gemmed with dew.
The last part of our gospel is very familiar, and where there's a shortage of priests, the words of our Lord cannot but be an encouragement to lay people to join together in prayer, as they always have done. And since the Vatican Council, there's been a flowering of so-called prayer meetings. Where two or three are gathered together, there am I in the midst of them. But the opposite also happens, and there are many churches in the Western world where there's no longer a congregation. Churches like this have been closed, destroyed, in some cases converted into dwellings or adapted for public use. But in a fanciful poem by Rudyard Kipling, we're transported back into the Dark Ages, when a priest refuses to close his church and celebrates a midnight mass for such as care to attend.
Eddie, priest of St. Wilfrid, in the chapel at Manhood End, ordered a midnight service for such as cared to attend. But the Saxons were keeping Christmas, and the night was stormy as well. Nobody came to service, though Eddie rang the bell. "Wicked weather for walking," said Eddie of Manhood End, "but I must go on with the service for such as care to attend." The altar candles were lighted. An old marsh donkey came, bold as a guest invited, and stared at the guttering flame. The storm beat on at the windows, the water splashed on the floor, and a wet, yoke-weary bullock pushed in through the open door. How do I know what is greatest? How do I know what is least? That is my father's business, said Eddie, Wilfred's priest. But three are gathered together. Listen to me and attend. I bring good news, my brethren, said Eddie of Manhood End. And he told the ox of a manger and a stall in Bethlehem, and he spoke to the ass of a rider that rode to Jerusalem. They steamed and dripped in the chancel. They listened and never stirred, while just as though they were bishops, Eddie preached them the word. Till the gale blew off on the marshes, and the windows showed the day, and the ox and the ass together wheeled and clattered away. And when the Saxons mocked him, said Eddie of Manhood End, I dare not shut his chapel on such as care to attend.
Warm thanks there to Gilbert Ulacqua and to Sean Patrick Lovett, whose voice you also heard. And now Joan Lewis affords us a little bit of background on the stunning island of Sardinia, the venue for Pope Benedict on Sunday, 7th of October. Let's join her as she delves into the origins of Christianity there with Tracy McClure.
There's one very interesting point. I went to the website of the Archdiocese of Cagliari, and Archbishop Mani asked all of the priests to be there within the Archdiocese, so there are going to be no other Masses Sunday in Cagliari.
Oh, isn't that
announcement mm-hmm. was made on the website. So I guess what you're going to have to do for people who work, I mean nurses or doctors or people who certainly would have to work, I guess they're just going to have to go to a Saturday night Mass or perhaps, obviously, later in the day, I don't know. But that's to allow all the faithful. I believe they're expecting 150,000 people for the Papal Mass, and they'll be on the step area, the huge steps leading up to the Basilica, and any of the neighboring areas and squares and so forth. But I thought that was just a very interesting fact that I gleaned from their website. Now, you know, looking at the island, the arrival of Christianity, all the popes associated with it, we know that Benedict is the third, shall we say, modern pope to visit after Paul VI in 1970 and John Paul II in 1985. So it's been a few years since a pope has visited. But, you know, we can go back to the third century if you want to look at popes, for example, who have been exiled in Sardinia. The very first one to be exiled, although he was not pope at the time. I mean, we have to be clear about that. But it was St. Calixtus. Of course, he was pope from 217 to 222. He had actually been exiled to the island. But when he came back to Rome, he started to take care of the graves of all the people today that we know as martyrs. And today, the spot where he took care of the graves of these people who were buried underground are known as the Catacombs of St. Calixtus.
And he, out on the Appia.
Out on the Via Appia.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and he became pope. Actually, he was exiled. He came back to Rome, was doing this work with the martyrs and saints. And he came back, and then he was elected pope.
When you say he was exiled, it would have been by the Romans, the Roman emperor.
Oh, yes. I mean, they were kind of behind everything. And you're going to see in a minute, I'm going to talk about the history of this island. And with the people that have been reigning, ruling over this island over the centuries, it's almost amazing. Sardinians don't speak about 12 different languages, as you'll see in a moment. But there was another pope exiled, and that was Saint Pansion. And of course, it's so interesting. These are some of the earlier popes. We do know very little about them because there were very few records ever written. But it seems with Pansion, who was pope from 230 to 235. There was a lost papal chronicle that was found centuries after he was pope, which had a little more information about him. And he'd been deported from Rome along with the anti-pope Hippolytus to Sardinia. Now, during his pontificate, the schism associated with Hippolytus came to an end, and Pansion and other church leaders, including Hippolytus, were exiled by the emperor Maximus Thrax to Sardinia. And it's not known exactly how long he stayed there, but he did die on the island. And it was said he died because of the inhuman treatment that he received in the Sardinian mines. Now, interestingly enough, Sardinia was an island that was very important to the Romans because it brought them a lot of salt and grain. Now, why is salt interesting? You know, in Rome, we have the Via Salaria, named actually for the salt. Not mines, but the salt that was,
taken in to the interior.
Salt was used as money in those days. Roman soldiers, for a long period of time, were actually paid in salt. It was such a commodity, be like somebody paying us today in, you know, gold or silver. So people were paid in salt. So for salt to come in for the Romans from Sardinia was a very important thing. Now, the Romans apparently did govern the island rather harshly. Now, listen to this, and anybody who can remember this and write us an email, I will give them a trip to Rome. Because
that's a big promise.
Well, all right, now listen to this. After the fall of Rome, Sardinia passed to the Vandals. That was like the mid-5th century. Then it went to the Byzantines. That was the mid-6th century. Now, the Byzantines kind of neglected Sardinia, and then the popes gained actually a lot of power there. And they claimed sovereignty over it and helped repel Arab attacks between the 8th and the 11th century. Then you have Pope Boniface VIII bestowing the island on the House of Aragon. And you remember Boniface VIII, of course, is associated with the First Jubilee in the year 1300. And then it passed from Aragon to Spain in the late 15th century. Then, a couple centuries later, we have the Peace of Utrecht after a war, and Spain ceded the island to Austria. But then in 1717, we have Cardinal Alberoni sending a Spanish force to occupy the island.
I see you've been doing your homework, Joan.
I've been doing my homework. And well, I knew so little, and I wanted to know more about Sardinia. And then you have a settlement of 1720 awards Sardinia to Victor Amadeus of Savoy, who called himself the King of Sardinia, and he exchanged that kingdom for Sicily, which was given to the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V. And then, of course, the kings of Sardinia, even though they were kings, they did reside in Turin. Now, interestingly enough, after the persecution of the Vandals, remember they were among the first occupiers of the island, Sardinia, but most especially Cagliari, did offer a refuge to many Catholic bishops from North Africa. And this is fascinating.
Oh, interesting.
So in the very early centuries of Christianity, so you have St. Eugenius, St. Fulgentius, and so forth. So they found the freedom of religion, freedom of worship in Sardinia that was denied in their own countries. And of course, St. Gregory the Great actually writes about a few of these. He corresponded with the two bishops of Cagliari, and that's Thomas and Januarius. Well, one very interesting point, we have to go to the year 1075 for this. We have Gregory the VII reproached the bishop of Cagliari for wearing a beard. Now, at that time, we're talking...
A beard.
A beard. This had become very fashionable on the island of Sardinia. But apparently Pope Gregory the VII did not like it, and he asked the judge. At that time, the island was ruled by people known as judges. And so the Pope asked the judge to tell the clergy to abandon beards. And apparently they did listen to the Pope. They were not happy people, but they did listen to the Holy Father.
What year was that?
This was 1075.
1075,
so 11th century. We also have, by the way, the Archbishop of Cagliari for a certain period of time was known as the Primate of Sardinia. And that Primate of Sardinia, see, here's all, I mentioned the word vicissitudes in an earlier, you know, transmission, and that's the perfect word to describe what I've just said now. I mean, all the peoples, all the countries, all the different rulers that Sardinia has had, and then you come to something relative to the Catholic Church, the title of Primate of Sardinia. and Corsica, was passed in 1158 to the Archbishop of Pisa. I'm not sure I can explain that or know the background, but that's what happened. And it says in my look at the history of the church there, it says in 1409, this title was given back, primate, to the Archbishop of Cagliari. And the history source I went to said that a controversy arose between Cagliari and Pisa, which has not yet been settled. I do not know the final line to this story. And you know what? Someday I'll come back and on another show post-Cagliari, I'll tell you what it is.
Well, I wonder if Pope Benedict will be making some sort of decision regarding the
yes.
the primacy, the primate position.
Right. I don't recall in modern times having heard that term associated with the Archbishop of either Pisa or...
No, neither have I, actually.
Yeah.
But,
so just an interesting little anecdote in history, but that's what history books are filled with, aren't they?
They sure are. Well, but getting back to Pope Benedict's visit, this is, of course, part of a whole string of visits, Marian pilgrimages that Pope Benedict has been making.
Well, not only in Italy, we said this is his 11th trip in Italy, but also on many of his trips abroad. Because in Italy, you have the Pope visiting, if our listeners recall, he went to Santa Maria di Leuca and Brindisi. And of course, that was just June of this year. And then he went to Savona and Genova, and that was May of this year. And he also went to Loreto, that was a year ago, September, when, of course, he met with all the young people. So a Marian shrine has always been the focal point, has been the focal point of many of his trips. And then if you look at the apostolic trips abroad, oh my word, you have Poland, the very first trip abroad he ever made as Pope, and he visited the shrine of Jasna Góra. Then he went to Valencia, Spain, went naturally for the meeting of families in July of 2006. And he visited the Basilica of the Virgen de los Desamparados and prayed, obviously, for all the victims of the there had been the subway accident just before the Pope's arrival in Valencia.
The attack on the subway.
If you recall
right,
that.
Sure.
Right, the attack on the subway. And then, of course, he went to Germany, obviously his own country, in 2006. And that was lovely. Altötting, I think, stands out as the biggest of the Marian shrines that he visited, which he had visited in his youth and growing up years and as many times as he possibly could.
And, of course, he will be making the culmination of this, at least this summer, to Lourdes.
Lourdes, exactly. So it's as if all the other visits, and how can we forget Maria Zell, Austria, last September, a year ago, almost as we speak, he went to Maria Zell. And so it's as if all of these have been a prelude to Lourdes. And I mean, his visit to Cagliari takes place days before he leaves for Paris.
Exactly.
And then Lourdes.
Exactly.
Obviously to commemorate the 150th anniversary of the apparition of Our Lady of Lourdes to Bernadette.
And a big thank you there, as always, to Joan Lewis, who put Sardinia in the picture for us there. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.